Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, New Year's Eve edition. Delighted to have you with us. It's just midnight in Berlin now. I said last hour, Happy New Year to the people in Berlin.
Well, Happy New Year in Berlin.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Berlin. Sorry, I jumped the gun on you a little bit.
New Year's just proleptic.
Yeah.
Even though you presented it as factual.
Yes. I realize that, Jimmy, but I'm making mistakes
you
this
still
year.
Have a few hours till you have to be perfect.
Yeah, I'm going to start being perfect for the year 2019. Let's see how long that goes. But if I sleep,
I think it goes 365.2422 days.
I think you are correct about the time of the year. I was wondering how long my perfection would last.
Well, you said it was going to last all year.
I said I'm going to try.
Okay.
I'm going to do my best.
Try or do not try. There is no try.
Do or do not do.
There is no try. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Yoda. Mm-hmm. Why does Yoda talk that way, by the way? What, is there an explanation? There must be some kind of retcon that tells us why Yoda talks that way.
So Yoda, I mean, the simple explanation is that George Lucas wanted him to sound different as a way of emphasizing his alienness.
Yeah.
And because not all languages have the same sentence structure. And so when you translate them from one language into another, you get unusual structures sometimes. And English, because it's a largely isolating language,
doesn't tend to
encode very much information about the function that the word is playing in the sentence into the word itself. It encodes a little bit, but not a lot. And so it has to rely on something else to tell you what function this word is playing in a sentence. So for example, if I have the words Peter, Paul, and hit, did Peter hit Paul or did Paul hit Peter? Now in Latin or Greek, I could change the words Peter and Paul to tell you which is the subject and which is the object. And from that, you would know who's hitting who, regardless of the order I put the words in.
Oh, how interesting.
But in English, I can't do that. Peter is just Peter. Paul is just Paul. The words don't change their forms. So in English, I put them in a certain order to tell you either Peter hit Paul or Paul hit Peter. But that's English. Other languages, because they change the form of the word more, you can tell what its function in the sentence is no matter where it gets placed. And so they have much more flexible word orders. Latin and Greek are examples of that. Mm-hmm. And in some languages, they will have a tendency to phrase things to where like the first word you hear is the one they're putting the emphasis on, regardless of the function that it's playing.
Oh.
And they also, in some languages, will have a tendency to put the verb last. Just some languages, not all.
Okay.
And so consequently, Yoda speaks in a kind of flexible Latinate way that where the sentence order varies, but he tends to put the verb at the end. So like, take you to the cloud city, I will.
Yeah.
Things like that. So he tends to have the verb at the end as one of Yoda's most notable speech characteristics.
Good old Yoda. We ended the last hour without ending our question or our answer.
It
to
was
a question.
Cliffhanger.
It was a cliffhanger.
So let's resolve the cliffhanger.
Let's go back to John asked just a series of what I find really great questions about pop culture, and you were in the midst of answering when the music started playing.
Yeah.
And so
– so just to recap, he was asking particularly about tabletop games and role-playing games, which have begun, according to him, incorporating more ideas from popular culture that that are incompatible with the Christian faith, like transgenderism, things like that. And so his first question was, when do you bail out?
Yeah.
He says up to a certain point, you can like ignore the problematic material or skip it or work around it or things like that. But when do you have to bail? And the answer is it's a judgment call that an individual is going to have to make on a case-by-case basis. Some of the factors that go into the judgment call include things like, number one, your own adherence to and knowledge of the faith. because if you're strong in your faith and you understand your faith well, yeah, it's going to help you navigate these waters better, and you'll know what to look out for better, and you'll be able to, you know, filter these things better and interact with others better on the subject. It's kind of like St. Paul reading Greek literature. St. Paul, if you look in his letters and also the way the speech that Luke represents him as giving in Acts chapter 17 in Athens, he quoted Greek literature, pagan Greek literature. So he's obviously familiar with it. That means St. Paul was reading pagan writers, talking about pagan gods, mm-hmm, and things like that. But he could still appropriate from those writings genuine insights that could be used in the service of the gospel. Well, St. Paul is very firm in his Christian faith. He's also very knowledgeable, so it's easier for him to read these pagan writings and extract material that's going to be useful for the gospel compared to someone who's like a new shaky Christian that, you know,
yeah,
maybe has a history of worshiping the pagan gods, and
right,
it's not as safe for them to be, you know, reading this material. So that's one of the factors. If you're encountering problematic literature, how well do you know your faith and how solid are you in it? Then there's the issue of the people you're dealing with, because it's not just you.
Right.
Another party in social interactions is other people. And if you're giving scandal to other people, I mean, anytime we do anything, there's a risk that someone is going to be misled. You cannot stop that. I mean, it shows up here on the radio. I will give answers that are perfectly sound, and sometimes I'll hear from people in the audience who just totally misunderstood what I said.
Yes. Right.
I'm sure that hasn't happened to you, but, you know.
I think people just dismiss what I say. They're not going to bother to send an email. They're like, oh, whatever. That's just him.
Well, in any event, it does happen. And so you have to be mindful of, you know, is engagement with this problematic material going to, even if it's not going to cause problems for me and lead me away from the faith or, yeah, into sin, is it going to do that for someone else who's in my group?
Right.
So that has to be taken into account. And then there's the third consideration, which John also mentions, which is the makers and distributors of the game, because they're making money off of this, and by giving them money for the game or the movie or the book or whatever it is, the you know, ticket price if you're going to see a theater, a play or a concert or something, you're giving them money. So at what point are you cooperating in their sin? There does come a point, but it's usually not as close as people think, because usually most things that people produce are fundamentally not a problem. They will contain things that are problems, because unlike you in the year 2019, Cy, yeah, most people are not perfect. And so they produce imperfect works, and yeah, it's just unavoidable that, yeah, that
you're really looking forward to being perfect.
Yeah.
I really,
yeah,
am.
But most things that most people produce are in the main okay, and only have a smaller admixture of problems. That was even true for the pagan literature Paul was reading.
Right, right.
And it's true of most novels and most movies, and, you know, the fundamental storyline usually is okay. Now, there are exceptions. And if you know going into something,
yeah,
that this is just one big, say, piece of abortion propaganda,
yeah,
or one big piece of homosexual lifestyle propaganda.
Or the Golden Compass, the thing that's...
Yeah, it was an attack on Christianity itself.
Right.
Well, in those circumstances, yeah, absolutely. Don't give those people your money.
Yeah.
I mean, even then there can be exceptions. Like, let's say you're a film reviewer who needs to warn people about what's in the Golden Compass.
Right, like Stephen Gray Donis.
Exactly. It's like an apologist reading a book on the Index of Forbidden Books.
Yeah.
Back when that existed. So there can be circumstances even then in which it's legitimate to do what you need to experience these things. But if you know that something is just a frontal attack on the Christian faith, well, then sure, don't give him your money for it.
Yeah.
But if there's an admixture, it's a judgment call.
John, thank you so much for that very interesting question, because I think that, there's something so practical in the question. He's not looking for an ideological answer. And I think a lot of people, I guess to put it this way.
Yeah. Oh,
pop, go ahead.
By the way, one other factor that's relevant is just your own preferences, because mm-hmm. a lot of these things are done for entertainment. And even if your own faith is strong and you're knowledgeable in your faith and you could sort through the problematic material, at some point it can rise to such a level that this just isn't fun anymore, having to go to that work of filtering.
Yeah.
And right. I just want to pull back from that. Oh, and in terms of his other question, what do you do if there's no alternative? Make your own.
Yeah. Or team up with somebody and make your own, maybe, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful strategy. I do think, especially parents, but everybody now, it feels like pop culture is an actual assault that you've got to make very fine distinctions very quickly. It just comes at you very fast. Mm-hmm. And it's good to have, well, it's just a practical problem. You got to keep making
culture those. Always does that.
I guess so. Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. Right.
Every age.
Jeff asks the following. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. That was an easy question.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Jeff. But he added more. Like, okay. Once again, there's
more to read. Awesome.
Would you? He would like you. So he phrases it this way. Hi, Jimmy. Would like your thoughts on something I heard on the local Catholic radio station.
Okay.
They had a Bible scholar on who said, we don't actually know how the Exodus happened. And that, quote, there are actually four or five different strands of Exodus accounts, end quote. She went on to quote from one of her former professors who said it might have only been that some Egyptians said to each other, gee, some Israelites ran away last night, which later in the text of the Old Testament evolved into this Cecil B. DeMille extraordinary manifestation of God's power when the Israelites later wrote their reflections of their experience. Wow, there's a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the Exodus?
Well, the Exodus, now you're going to have different scholars, some of a skeptical stripe who will say, oh, this never happened. But I think that's nonsense. Having a TARDIS, it's really hard.
Yeah, right.
At jimmyakin.com, I have an article on did the Exodus happen? And I conclude it did. And I think evidence for that is found in the fact that the Israelites say we used to be slaves in Egypt. Now, any account, I mean, this is the function of language is to communicate information. And so unless you have reason to challenge what somebody said, the starting point is assuming that they're accurate.
Yeah.
But in this case, I think there's a particular reason, not just because of the general function of language, but I think there's a further reason to say that this claim is true, because it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And when people make up stories and legends about their origins, either they say, oh, we've always been in this land,
yeah,
because that gives us a title to it. It's right. Like no one else has ever lived here. This is all us. So we have the title here, clear and undisputable.
Right.
They will make up glorious stories about their past. It's like, oh, yeah.
And then Romulus and Remus.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so what you don't find is people making up shameful stories about their past, like we used to be slaves and in this neighboring country that's a major world power and we were all humiliated and then we got out of there and came to this new place. So criterion that's often used in biblical studies to say, okay, there's good evidence that this is true, is the criterion of embarrassment. And I think that applies to the Exodus. So so I think that the biblical writers give us good evidence that the Exodus occurred. Also, the books that describe it, and this is just my dating, other people date them differently, I think that Genesis was and the Pentateuch was composed around the year 1000 BC, about the time of David. And the Exodus took place either between 200 and 400 years before that, depending on how you date it. Different scholars date it differently. Most think it was about 200 years before that. And that's certainly long enough to remember how your nation got there. I mean, if you even even if we had no books from the time of the Revolutionary War,
there'd be stories.
There'd be stories. We would have remembered how America got here 200 years ago,
yeah,
or even 400 years ago. Oh yeah, our ancestors immigrated from Europe. How about that? You know, so founding stories like that tend to be remembered for the kind of length of time that would have passed before the writing of the Pentateuch. So I think there's a bunch of good evidence for it. Now, having said that, there is a phenomenon where people do tend to glorify how things happened, and sometimes biblical authors use hyperbole.
Yeah.
They'll exaggerate things for purposes of glorification. You see this all the time in the Psalms, you know, for example, because it's a common poetic device. Like when the psalmist says, "I shall awaken the dawn," he doesn't literally mean the dawn is like this. He's going to go to the bed where the sun is and shake the sun and get the sun to wake up.
Get up, buddy.
Yeah. He means I'm so happy that I am so enthralled with God that it's as if I could stay up all night singing God's praises.
Yeah.
And so when we look at very early texts that describe events written long before they were recorded, you tend to get more of that. That's why the early chapters of Genesis, as the Catechism acknowledges, uses more figurative language. They still record things that are real, but they record them in a more figurative way because they didn't
That's what happens with – yeah.
Yeah, they didn't have eyewitness accounts, and so there's a certain amount of literary reconstruction that happens.
I want to ask you what you think actually happened at the Exodus, if we get a little more into that, but I am really late for the break, so I got to take a quick break.
Okay.
I apologize for that, Jimmy. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Our mission is to transform the world one woman at a time through a spiritual program of formation that helps them to see who they are as daughters of the Most High God and to enjoy the gift that God has given to them by virtue of their femininity.
Women of Grace with Jeanette Bankovic Williams. Tomorrow morning, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we're just wrapping up a question from Jeff about whether or not the Exodus happened, or is the story just a big exaggeration, or that kind of thing. I guess with the Gospels, we're within a few years,
right?
But with the Exodus stories, we're
a couple of centuries.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be exactly the same. There's no living person who remembers it in the way the Gospels,
right? And so consequently, you would expect there to be a little bit more literary reconstruction and things like that in the accounts of the Exodus that we find in the Pentateuch. But fundamentally, I think the event happened, and you know exactly how big the numbers were, and exactly all of the details. That's something that people can and do debate, but it sounds like the kind of dismissive statements that the listener reports being made on the local radio station are something that I wouldn't find particularly helpful for people.
No, indeed. Okay, Jeff, thanks so much for that question. We go now to a question from Tobias, who asks, are we morally obligated to put our lives on the line to save the Blessed Sacrament from, and he puts this in quotes, harm? For example, sacrilegious abuse, vandalism, etc.
It's a very interesting question. Now, I have to distinguish between what's morally obligatory and what's morally praiseworthy.
Okay.
Because there are things that we are required to do absolutely. It's like you just must do this or you must make your best efforts to do this. But then there are things where even though we're not required to do it, it is praiseworthy to do it, and it will gain merit before God if we do it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
For example, we are not required to we are required to not deny the Christian faith. So if the state persecutes you and demands to know, are you a Christian, and we're going to kill you if you are, you cannot say, no, I'm not a Christian. You cannot deny Christ. That's an absolute.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that when a time of persecution comes, you can't flee or go into hiding or something like that, rather than continuing to make a public profession of faith. However, if you do continue to make a public profession of faith and you get martyred as a result, that can be morally praiseworthy. It's going beyond – the fancy word for it is supererogatory, more than what's required.
Okay.
And so so in terms of defending the Eucharist, I'm not aware of any magisterial document that deals with this. So I'm just thinking in terms of Catholic moral theology principles here. It seems to me that that we have a situation where certain behaviors are going to be required, but certain also could be supererogatory. So for example, if you can reasonably, without, say, grave harm to yourself, protect the Eucharist from desecration, then you would be obliged to do so. It would be required because it's grave matter to for someone to desecrate the Eucharist. And if you have the ability without incurring grave harm to yourself, it would seem obligatory to stop the grave thing from happening.
Yes.
However, if you would incur grave harm, then it seems to me that you're not obliged to do so. So let's say there's a church that's on fire and it's burning and there's a tabernacle in there with consecrated hosts, and you could try to run into the burning church and get the hot metallic tabernacle out, but given the state of the church at the moment, there's also a high likelihood that you would be injured and even killed, perhaps overcome by smoke inhalation.
Right.
And it seems to me that in that circumstance, no, you wouldn't be required to run into the burning church to get the tabernacle or attempt to get the tabernacle. It might be supererogatory for you to do so, or it might even be so unlikely that you could get it out of there without dying yourself that it could be so likely that you would both fail to get it out
and
die yourself that actually it would cease to be supererogatory and become foolish to go in there. So I think that there's a range of possibilities, and you have to look at all of the facts and circumstances that apply in order to assess which moral category is going to apply to defending the Eucharist or attempting to defend the Eucharist in a particular situation. One thing that's also something to be borne in mind, Jesus knew there would be desecrations of the Eucharist when he instituted this sacrament, and he chose to make himself vulnerable in this way. And that's – he didn't have to. He chose to do this. And he's also perfected in glory in heaven. His happiness is perfected. He's not experiencing any suffering no matter what happens here on earth. And so to the accidents, because he's unharmed in heaven.
Yes.
It's the accidents that get corrupted. So those are also things to bear in mind when thinking about these kind of situations.
Thank you very much, Tobias, for that question. You said there's not really a magisterial teaching on that, a document somewhere.
No, there are things that talk about they're not these extreme kind of cases.
Yeah.
But like what happens if a host falls to the floor, what do you do?
Yeah.
Well, there are documents to talk about that. You pick it up. And if there are – under current legislation – if there are fragments that are left, you know, that would contain the real presence, well, then you collect them and dissolve them in water.
But with the different kinds of documents, I wish that there were a book that would help me to understand what weight to give the different documents and help me cut through, you know, doctrinal confusion.
If only someone would write a book like
understand
that.
Understand what the church really says. That's what I would like. Something about maybe
– tell you what. In 2019, I'll invent a time machine and go back in the past and write such a book so that you can have it now. How about that?
That is great.
wait, Jimmy, look what just popped up. Did you get already? You did the time machine thing.
Because, I will have done the time machine.
Wait, that's all confusing to me, the timeline. But Teaching with Authority, How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says is Jimmy's book about just that subject. And he did get in a time machine, travel back to.
Will have gotten in a time machine.
And he published it in November of 2018.
Yeah.
Even though he wrote it in 2019 as a favor to me.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for doing that, Jimmy.
I wanted you to have it now. I didn't want to. I mean, after all, if you're going to be perfect in 2019, you're going to need to be able to perfectly weigh those church documents.
But time travel seems like really like you went above and beyond.
Well.
I'm very touched.
Thank you.
By that.
For you, Cy, anything.
Really? Even was it a TARDIS or you had to invent?
I'll have to find out.
You'll have to find out. You don't know yet how you did it. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Our topic, well, whatever came in across the internet is our topic. It's an internet open forum. We're taking any question at all about the Catholic faith, but they all came to us via internet. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Advent is upon us and Christmas approaches. Catholic Answers wants you to know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter the promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new products on doctrine, church history, morality, apologetics, and much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com today to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout and save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
The Catholic Church claims to be the religion in which the fullness of truth resides, but at times getting to the heart of any particular question of doctrine or morals can lead not only to personal confusion, but conflict and even disagreement among Catholics. In his new book, Teaching with Authority, Jimmy Akin sets the record straight. Teaching with Authority isn't about understanding specific teachings of the faith, but rather about understanding Catholic teaching itself. A unique, valuable, and long overdue resource for Catholics as well as those inquiring about the faith, Teaching with Authority will help deepen your understanding of what the Church teaches by showing you, maybe for the first time, how, why, and where it does. Get your copy of Teaching with Authority today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life. That's tomorrow on More to Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Pretty soon, the entire world will be in the new year, just a few hours away from the
entire...
You say
that like it's a plot of world domination or something.
That's right. It is. 2019 has conspired. That little baby, 2019, is pushing the old man out everywhere around the world. Soon, the old man will be... what is he, vanquished? I don't know what you do the old year will be vanquished. It's Internet Open Forum today with Jimmy Akin and Angel... On the internet asks the following, Jimmy, maybe try and explain what the heck is going on with the Vatican and China.
I like
the way he phrased it, too.
Yeah. So, obviously, communist China is a country where the state feels very threatened by any belief system that stands apart from its own. And that includes Christianity. It includes Islam. It includes anything you want. That's the nature of totalitarian societies, is to be very afraid of challenge to their views. And so the Chinese government has persecuted Christians in China, including Catholics, and that's resulted in an underground church, which for many years has had bishops that were appointed by the Pope and that were ordained secretly and that would lead the church in hiding in China. But China has also, the Chinese government has established what it calls the Patriotic Catholic Church, which is essentially a church containing many Catholics who are in union with the Pope, but who are being led by bishops that were appointed by the Chinese government and ordained in many cases in irregular situations. And so there's a question of what approach should the Holy See take in this situation. And for the last number of pontificates, the Holy See has been wrestling with this question, and they've tried to arrange a situation where there is a reunification of these two churches to find a way to enable the persecuted Catholics to come out of the shadows and also to facilitate a greater union between the Patriotic Church and Rome, and then find a way to work with the Chinese Communist government. Now, and recently, there have been some developments in this regard. There has been an accord that was signed under Pope Francis with the Chinese government that would and the provisions of this accord are not publicly spelled out. The text of the accord has not been released.
Okay.
But in Pope Francis's judgment, this was the best way to ensure pastoral care and evangelization in China going forward. It is not the view of everybody that this is the best way. In fact, a Chinese cardinal named Zen or Shen is very strongly of the opinion that this is a disaster, that it's essentially selling out the Chinese church and its cause to the communists, and that it's going to harm the cause, not just the safety and pastoral care of those Catholics in China who are trying to be faithful to the church, but also it's going to impede the progress of evangelization in China, because in areas where the argument goes, in areas where the church has been seen as too much in line with an oppressive regime, when that regime falls, the church consequently suffers. And so there's a judgment call that has to be made here about what's the best way to protect and promote the church and the cause of the gospel in China. Do you work with the system or challenge the system? What combination of working and challenging do you use? And it's a subject on which there is a wide diversity of opinion.
Angel, thanks very much for that question. Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. Tony asks this, Jimmy: is the mark of the beast going to be a chip implanted into the hand or head?
So it's like one or the other? Which is it going to be?
Yeah. Will it be the hand or will it be? No, yeah. I think it's like,
yeah. Yeah, no, I know what he means. Yeah, so okay. This is an idea that you started hearing a few decades ago after computer chips started to be made. Mm-hmm. People would take a particular passage in the Book of Revelation and try to apply it to our own day or our near future. And they came up with this idea. And I first remember hearing about this in the 1970s. It was kind of part of the big Protestant wave of eschatological speculation that was like the late great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey and a bunch
of
other
things. Scared the daylights out of me.
Yeah, me too. And so the idea was, you would even hear claims that there's this computer in Belgium called the Beast, and it like calculates things in a 6x6x6 matrix and stuff like that.
Wow. In Belgium.
Yeah.
Those Belgian guys have always been a problem.
Yeah. Well, they gave us Brussels sprouts, so, you know.
I love Brussels sprouts.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Interesting. They are food on which there is a wide diversity of opinion.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case.
In any event, what Revelation says is that the number of the beast is 666, or in some manuscripts it actually says 616. There's a little bit of question, what was the original? It says that that the mark of the beast, his number, will be placed either on the right hand or the forehead of his followers, and that unless you're one of his followers with this mark, you won't be able to buy or sell. And the question is, what is this real? How would this have been understood when Revelation was originally written? So the first thing is they didn't have computer chips when Revelation was originally written.
No Apple?
Yeah, not of that kind. And so they wouldn't have understood this as involving computer chips. What they would have understood it is involving is tattoos. Because that was what you did with slaves sometimes, was you would tattoo them to indicate who their owner is.
Okay.
It's like branding cattle. You put your brand on your cattle so that it's obvious to people this is Lester's cow or whatever. In the same way, people would sometimes brand slaves so that they would tattoo slaves so that it was obvious who their master was. So this is that's how it would have been understood, not in terms of implanting a chip, but in terms of applying a tattoo. So that's the first question. How would this image have been understood on the literal level, if you take it literalistically? Then there's the further question, what would it mean? Because Revelation uses a lot of symbols. Maybe this is a symbol. Maybe it's not referring to a literal tattoo that's going to be on someone's hand or head. What else could it mean? Are there any other plausible candidates? Well, since we know that the fundamental image here is one of slavery or servitude, it could just be an indication that you are one of the followers of the beast and you're part of his system, your allegiance is to him. Your activities symbolized by your right hand are directed to his service. Your thoughts are directed to his service. So there's your forehead. And it might not mean there's going to be a literal tattoo of the beast, but just that his followers are symbolized as having one because they direct their thoughts and their actions to his service.
I see.
And that if you're not one of these people, you can then suffer economic harm because you're not going with the system, and it's going to harm your business relationships, among other things.
Right.
And so given that – and we've talked about this elsewhere, but given that the beast in Revelation seems to be identified, at least in its primary reference, not with something in our future – but with the first century line of Roman emperors, and specifically with Nero Caesar, whose name in Hebrew and Aramaic adds up to either 666 or 616, depending on how you spell it.
Okay.
It looks like the cult of Roman emperor worship is what's being talked about here. And so the idea would be that people who are – who partake in Roman emperor worship and partake of the social benefits that confers, including – and this was big in Asia, by the way, Asia Minor, where Revelation is written to.
Yeah.
There were lots of these cities. They would vie with each other for the right to build temples to Caesar.
Oh, yeah.
So that – and then Caesar – and they would do that in the expectation that Caesar would then confer benefits on them.
Yeah.
And if you – publicly dissented from all of this, you were out of step with the civic spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Get the pun. And and see what I did there?
Yes, I see.
And you would be ostracized, your business would be hurt, and so forth. And we even read about, if you look in Hebrews and some other early Christian documents, there is criticism of some Christians for being too complicit with the with the anti-Christian social order as a way of furthering their business investments and so forth, instead of clinging and standing with the Christian community.
I see.
And so it looks to me like that's the literal fulfillment of this passage in history, that it applies to the first century and the cult of Roman emperor worship, and computer chips really don't come into it. Having said that, I also think that Revelation very likely contains echoes of things that will happen in the future. And so so there may be a further future fulfillment of the Mark of the Beast before the end of the world. And I can't exclude that it would involve computer chips, but that's simply a matter of speculation.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I'm going to tell you something, Jimmy, just between you and me in confidence. There's a very prominent member of the Catholic Answers family who has a computer chip in his arm.
Really?
I'm not going to tell you who it is because I didn't get permission, but I'm going to tell you why it happened.
Uh-huh.
He went in to have his dog, the chip put in the dog.
Okay.
And he's holding
like
the dog.
Like tracking the dog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's holding the dog. And it's just one of those serendipitous things.
This is an RFID chip, radio frequency identification chip.
Right. Uh-huh. So the dog moves and the chip goes in his arm.
Oh, boy.
And so then they were like, well, we could take it out, but we got to cut you, you know, like, and if you leave it in, it doesn't do any harm.
I wonder who on the Catholic Answers staff would be prominent and have dogs that are valuable enough that you need to chip them for ID purposes.
It's not Chris Check.
Oh, okay.
That was good though. But no, it's not Chris Check. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. I'll tell you at the break, but I don't have this person's permission to share this.
Thank you
hilarious
for protecting their confidence.
But I think that's hilarious that he's walking around with a chip in his arm. The storewide summer sale. Excuse me, the storewide Christmas sale continues because it's still Christmas. If you only believe, right? Have faith in the liturgical calendar of the Catholic Church. Christmas continues until midnight tonight.
Actually, Christmas continues until January, but our sale continues till midnight.
Right,
tonight.
I phrased that. That was ill phrased, but that's all right. It's not time for me to be perfect yet. A few more hours till I got to be perfect for the year 2019. You can still save on hundreds of items in our online shop. You use the promo code CALIVE18 at checkout when you visit shop.catholic.com. 30% off a whole bunch of stuff. Use that promo code CALIVE18 at shop.catholic.com until midnight tonight.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
It's the start of a new day and a new year for Morning Glory.
What are you listening to when you're getting ready to get the kids to school? What are you listening to on that drive-in that's going to wake up your spirit and begin your day focusing and thinking about the faith?
You're going to know you're listening to people that care about what you're doing. We want you to get to heaven, too. We all want to get there together, and we can have fun doing it.
So it's like your morning cup of coffee for your soul.
Me included.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers joins Gloria Purvis and the Morning Glory team Monday, January 14th on EWTN Radio.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum, but it's an internet open forum. All the questions today come from the internet, and answering those questions is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin, the author of Teaching with Authority, How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says, which just came out within the last 8 weeks or so.
Yeah.
You know what? There's that sale.
Metaphorically hot off the presses.
Right. Some of them may actually be physically hot off the presses. I don't know. It's pretty new. Let's continue with our internet open forum. We'll go to a question from Michael, who asks, do you think the Ark of the Covenant is really hidden in Ethiopia?
So the claim, for people who may not be aware of it, is that the Ark of the Covenant was taken from Israel and is currently housed in a church in Ethiopia, or a monastery, a shrine in Ethiopia, I believe at Aksum. And the Ethiopian Orthodox Church will not let anybody in to see what they've got. Mm-hmm. But they certainly encourage people to believe that it's the Ark of the Covenant. And it's part of kind of Ethiopian culture to believe that that they have the Ark of the Covenant there. My memory of the claim of how they got it is that it's claimed that Solomon gave it to the Queen of Sheba, or the Queen of the South, and Ethiopia is in the South from Egypt's from Israel's perspective, and it was sent at that time. That particular claim I find extraordinarily implausible. There's no way that Solomon gave the holiest valuable object in all of Israel.
Before you hit the road, I got something for you.
Yeah, he gave her presents, but not that.
Okay.
And so I find that claim very implausible. And in the absence of that claim, you then would have to account for how it got to Ethiopia. It appears that the Ark disappears from history about the time of the Babylonian exile, and most understand the Babylonian exile, the conquest of Jerusalem by Babylonian forces, as being the event that's responsible for the disappearance of the Ark. And it's sometimes thought they may have destroyed it. Mm-hmm. In perhaps either for political, religious reasons or to get it because it's got gold on it and it's valuable, or it may have been taken into exile. And we do have references to the Babylonians taking the temple treasures with them, but not the Ark. It's not mentioned.
Oh.
And so so it'll say like they took the menorah, the lampstand, but it doesn't say they took the Ark. And so that has led others to speculate that it's been hidden. And there are accounts of various sorts describing it being hidden. For example, in 2 Maccabees, there is an account in chapter 2 of 2 Maccabees that says that Jeremiah took it and the furnishings of the tabernacle and hid them in a cave on a mountain. And and so that's one of the stories that's there.
So this place in Ethiopia, is it a cave on a mountain?
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
Also, though, because of the way the 2 Maccabees account is phrased, it's not clear that it's like it says, and we found this in the records.
Oh, okay.
That this is what happened. It's not framed in the same way as this is definitely what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of whether the Babylonians took the Ark or they destroyed the Ark or it got hidden, it's unlikely that the hiding would have involved taking it as far as Ethiopia. Because that's way – I mean, Ethiopia is in Africa below Egypt.
Yeah. Right.
Now, you might be able to get there sort of – I mean, you'd have to go through all the southern wasteland and then get into the Red Sea or the Arabian Gulf and then get around to Ethiopia. Or you'd have to travel down the Nile, which is a major, major undertaking that would have been really hard. And it's just unlikely. And there wasn't a major Jewish colony in Ethiopia at the time to go to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unlikely that the actual Ark would have been taken there. I do think, though, that it's probable that the Ethiopian church has an artifact and that they think it's the Ark. What I suspect it is, though, is a reconstruction of the Ark that was made at some point in history, and then the memory of, hey, this is our reconstruction of the Ark got blurred into, hey, this is the Ark.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So if you were able to go into that church, you would in fact see something that you might say, hey, that looks an awful lot like the Ark of the Covenant.
Or at least it looks like what people perceived the Ark to look like when it was made or at some later point.
All right. Ryan, well, first of all, let me just say to Michael, thank you for that question.
By the way, I'm going to be talking about that on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at some point here.
I forgot to mention Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, your other major undertaking of recent times.
One
this
of
year.
Several.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ryan asks this, why doesn't the church update the scientific proof of miracles from the Shroud of Turin or Lanciano? That's a Eucharistic miracle in Lanciano, Italy, et cetera. Why doesn't the church have more science done on these things, Jimmy?
I think for a couple of reasons. One of them is that the scientific tests are – well, there's several things to say here. The first one is the scientific tests regarding the Shroud have been mixed. There have been some studies of the Shroud, including a carbon dating study that was done a number of years ago that suggested the Shroud is a cloth dating from medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people would come out and say, well, you may have taken a part of the cloth where it had been repaired in medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if you tested another part of the cloth, it would show something different. And so you have these different sides arguing about that. The problem is the carbon dating is a destructive technology.
Yeah.
And you have, so you have to destroy part of the shroud in order to test it. Similarly, DNA analysis at this point, like if you wanted to run DNA analysis on the Eucharistic miracle of Lanciano, you have to destroy part of it. And so whereas the church has been willing to allow some of these tests to be run in some situations, it's very cautious about doing so. And it may be that in the future, it will be possible to have less destructive or even non-destructive tests.
Yeah.
You may be able to measure the amount of carbon-14 in something by waving a device over it, or
yeah.
you may be able to read DNA by using a powerful microscope or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it, so in the future, if the technology becomes less destructive, it may be that the church would be more willing to have it run on and have additional studies run. But shy of a technological advancement like that, the church is probably going to continue to be hesitant to allow destructive tests to be run on these things. There's also a risk of distraction and a kind of paradoxical undermining of the faith that could happen. Because let's suppose another carbon-14 test got run on the shroud.
Yeah.
And let's suppose it was consistent with the first.
Yeah.
Well, the headline would be shroud proved a fake.
Yeah.
All over the world. And so there's because you don't know what the test is going to say until you run it.
Yeah.
And you've already had one test that said medieval.
Right.
And so even though there are counter arguments to that, you've had one test and then you'd have to fight the whole battle all over again. Well, maybe this is also a place that got repaired, or the test got corrupted, or the lab did it wrong, or who knows what.
Right.
But what would be the takeaway for the vast majority of people hearing this claim is medieval forgery.
Yeah.
And whether it is a miracle or it's not, it has a net negative effect on evangelization to have major world headlines that say shroud medieval forgery.
Yeah.
And so I can understand how from an ecclesiastical perspective, you would say we don't want to go around that bush again right now, given the way
yeah.
the press is and how it wouldn't help
and
most
the pressure
people's
to
faith.
Do it every year when they come up with a new thing would be enormous. Oh, you did that one. Do this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, in terms of the Eucharistic miracle, so I assume what the listener's thinking of there is like doing a DNA test on it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
the problem right. is we don't have Jesus' DNA, and so we don't know what
right.
his DNA would have been like. And even if you extracted sequenceable DNA from this miracle, it wouldn't necessarily be matchable with Jesus or with what's on the shroud, because the shroud was on public display for centuries. It's got all kinds of people's DNA all over it from pilgrims kissing it and stuff.
Yeah.
Ew.
Sorry.
Pilgrims kiss things.
I know.
It's,
but,
admit it's a sign of love and respect. Do you say ew when your wife kisses you?
Not every time.
Okay. Glad you're able to restrain yourself sometimes.
I think I got
to have to. You'll have to be perfect though in 2019.
I'm already thinking I might have bitten off more than I can chew in 2018. I mean 2019.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So I'm already rethinking the perfection thing.
It's good
I might
to,
just try to be pretty good.
You've been thinking about your past
failures
resolution. Well,
oh,
no.
Oh.
It's good to think about the past. They even have a song about that people sing at this time of year.
I don't know what the words of that song mean, though. I'm
uh-huh.
assuming you're pointing to the song Auld Lang Syne.
Auld Lang Syne.
Syne.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
German?
Scotch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and it means?
A poem by Robert Burns. Auld Lang Syne literally means old long since. So you're
oh.
thinking about days old long since or days a long time ago.
Ah.
And we're going to raise a cup of cheer to toast and remember all of the times long ago and all the people we've known and loved.
Even though it's a pre-record?
Even though it's a pre-record.
I'm really glad that I'm ending 2018 with you, Jimmy Akin.
Me too.
It's such a privilege to get to work with you.
Likewise, Si.
Well, God bless you in the new year. Tomorrow is the Feast of Mary, Mother of God. The Mass times will be listed on your parish's website, probably. You never know, but probably.
High probability.
And high probability. And we'll see you in the new year, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.